good evening. My name's Sarah. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Sarah.
Happy Super Bowl Sunday. Yeah, I'm touched that I was asked to do this, first of all, and that people actually came tonight. So hopefully I'll carry a message of hope and recovery and not make you choose the other way when you go home and watch football later. My sobriety date is August 15th, 2011. And like I said, I'm from Richmond, so this gives me about 4.5 years-ish. And this was not my first white chip. And I'm nervous, so I feel better when I just throw that out there. I know that we're all friends and we're all in this together, but still it's kind of nerve-wracking sharing my story, because it's kind of like bearing your soul. And I'm always fearful if that self-centeredness, that I'm fearful I'm going to say something and make myself look stupid. But, you know, we've all been there. But... yeah, no, I'm active in Alcoholics Anonymous. I have a sponsor. I sponsor other women. I have a home group in Richmond. It's called the Buford Road Group. We meet Wednesday nights at 7. It's a great meeting. It's a step meeting. The first Wednesday of every month, we have a main speaker. So you're welcome to come anytime, and you can hit me up after the meeting if you want information about that. I don't think I've ever seen anyone here there except for Billy and Lynn. They've been our anniversary speakers before. I have a brother in recovery. A lot of you know him. And I am so grateful that he is not here tonight. It's just, oh, wow. You know, it's so nerve-wracking talking in front of him. But so I'm just going to follow the suggested format of the big book. I'm going to share what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like now. And thanks to Alcoholics Anonymous, I've been given a life that I've never imagined that I'd be able to have. I've always been affected by the illness of alcoholism. I grew up in an alcoholic household. Hey, good evening. I grew up in alcoholism. My dad's an alcoholic. You know, I know that our big book says that we can't diagnose anyone, but he, you know, if I could take a lucky guess, he's most like me out of anybody in my family, even my brother. I grew up with this, I was the youngest of three children. And I've just always been consumed with myself. I mean, from my very first memories, even now, it's like sometimes, you know, I think about myself all the time, and I think that's normal. Mm-hmm. I didn't know that I was already suffering from the spiritual malady of alcoholism. I didn't realize that other people don't have that that kind of fear. I always worried about what other people thought of me. I always worried about, I worried about everything. There's a picture of me in my preschool where... all the kids are gathered together for this group photo, and I'm standing off to the side with the teddy bear. It's like, and that's a metaphor for my life. Like, I could never be a part of, because I was so self-conscious. And I would have told you that I was shy, but it was all just self. And our big book talks about that with the alcoholic, of this extreme self-centeredness. So I definitely feel like I've needed a drink since preschool, you know? Absolutely. I just could not connect in with others. And even growing up, I've only had one friend at a time, you know, one or two friends. And it was just all self. Now, growing up in the home, I want to preface this with, I love my father, and thanks to amends in this program, we actually have a relationship now, and I think he's adorable, and I find him hysterical, because I've gotten well around the situation. But growing up, you know, I really suffered as a child, because I didn't understand what was going on with him. I knew that he drank a lot. I knew that he was very violent. He was a post-Vietnam War vet, and I kind of attributed the way he was. I just thought, I had heard stuff about Agent Orange and things like that, and, you know, post-traumatic stress disorder from wars, and I just kind of thought that he was crazy. And it wasn't until I started getting older that I linked his craziness to the alcohol, and I thought that the alcohol made him crazy. Like, I didn't know what alcoholism was. You know, I just thought, I thought that drinking was bad, and I kind of made a decision. I thought he was weak. My brother would start drinking he would start drinking around, like, 12 or 13 years old. So I saw the men in the household drinking, and I just kind of thought, you know, they're men, they're weak. I'll never do that. I'll never drink, because I saw what alcohol did to people. And I thought that the violence, and my brother was always getting trouble in school. My dad was just very explosive in the home, like smashing up furniture and stuff like that. I never knew what to expect when he came home. And again, it's like I just thought it was because of the drinking. And I made this firm decision that I wasn't going to drink. I was going to be successful, or I was going to go to school. I was going to be something other than that. Now, had I known what the alcohol would do for me, I would have definitely drank way earlier than I did, because I didn't realize the effects that it would give me. You know, I love feeling altered, and I definitely drink because I love the effects produced by alcohol, absolutely. I mean, it gets that me off of me that I was just explaining to you about. I was a good student. I never stole. I was just I was a good kid. I was really attached to my mom. The first time I drank, it was for my sweet 16th birthday, and I had a best friend named Tracy, and I don't remember how we got it, but we got a giant bottle of Bowman's Virginia vodka, which is like that bottom shelf stuff. It's like $5 for a gallon or something. And we got that, and we hid it in her bedroom, and we got a six-pack of Bud Light. And on my sweet 16th, we just hid it in the room, so there's no fridge or anything. And the night of my sweet 16th birthday, we just drank it warm, and we were playing Monopoly. And I remember that feeling of, like, chugging the vodka and just being like, you know. But I wanted to get drunk because all the cool kids at school were talking about drinking and the fun stuff they were doing on the weekends. So I already had a mission, like, you know, I wanted to get drunk, and I definitely did. And that was easily one of the best nights of my life. Because what happened to me, it was so much fun. I loved catching a buzz. I felt connected with her. Like, I finally felt like something was going on in me that I'd been missing. Like, I didn't realize how in angst I was. Because that stuff that I talked to you about from preschool, that all that, like, and the what are people thinking of me and the not fitting in, like, I mean, it just got more painful as time went on. Like, I was so just outside of the realm of what everybody else was doing. And I hid myself in books, so when I finally drank and got that release, it was awesome. And I definitely wanted to do it again, and my head ended up in the toilet. I remember blacking out and browning out that night, but there really were no consequences. We didn't get caught or anything like that. But it started something with me, because I told you I had been a good kid, and it's I just kind of had a one-track mind after that. Like, I couldn't wait to get drunk again, and so situations would show up, and I was definitely on the hunt. After that, you know, I made friends with some kids from another high school, skaters, like I remember those, like skater boys, and just kind of starting to sneak around, not tell my parents where I was going, and then I went off to college, and I went to an out-of-state college because I knew that I didn't want to be in Charlottesville, like I wanted to get away, you know, stuff was still going on in the home, and I thought maybe if I just went to a whole different state, I could start over and be a new person, And that's another theme that kind of carried me through my life. You know, I'll feel better if I go here, or I'll feel better if I do that, or if I become that. And again, it's just me trying to escape from me. And I learned over time I can't do that. Like, I can't do it. I still can't do it, you know. But, yeah, so I went to this college in West Virginia, and it was definitely a party school. And this is where the consequences started. You know, I was put in alcohol classes basically from the jump, you know. There was a bad snowstorm in my freshman year of college, and they found my roommate and I. I had drank a bottle of Southern Comfort and half of a bottle of Captain Morgan Spice Rum with this girl, and we had drank this within an hour. And then they found us out laying in the snow in the snowstorm in our party clothes, like we were trying to walk to the bar, and that, like, you know, I had my first experience with, like, alcohol classes. But I didn't care. Like, we thought it was funny. You know, it's like, yeah, I'm an alcoholic. Like, woo. I didn't care, like, at all. It was a fun school. I mean, I don't know if y'all remember Whippets. It's like, so Whippets were legal at a bar there called Mutt's. Like, you could buy a tray of cartridges and a balloon and just go to town. Like, it was every alcoholic's, you know, dream. It was like Shangri-La. I had so much fun, but I didn't know what I was doing. I kept my grades up somehow. It was functional. But then, you know, I ended up coming back home, and it was just problematic. You know, I felt like from the first time I drank, I've always been a blackout drinker, and I've just been crazy. And I come back home, and I get it in my head. I'm suffering these things that I don't realize, like, are kind of hand-in-hand with alcoholism, like severe depression when I'm not drinking, and this loneliness, and just, like, this not feeling good in my own skin, and just feeling like the walls are closing in, and I'm going to be doomed. You know, I drove up here with a friend tonight, and we were talking about it. It shows up in my recovery still, even when things are going good, and I feel like I've gotten sober in so many areas of my life that I never thought I'd get sober in, like financially, with my kids, in the workplace, with my friendships, still, you know, it'll hit me, this thing, like something's wrong. It's this existential thing, like, and I can't even put my finger on what it is, like we're going to die someday or whatever it is. Like, I get this, like, freaked out heaviness feeling, and it's like, I think my body needs a drink or something, but it's like, that's how I know that what I have is spiritual, that it's something spiritual in nature, because if it was not something that was spiritual, all those things would have fixed it. You know what I'm saying? Like, I'd be okay now, and I wouldn't need to come to AA meetings. You know, I wouldn't need to carry the message or anything like that or help anyone. But, so yeah, I come home, and I'm suffering from this thing, you know, depression, I'm seeing psychiatrists to kind of figure out what's wrong with me. Every time I get prescriptions, I totally abuse them. I remember I used to live alone in this apartment, and I loved taking Ambien and drinking a six-pack of Miller Lite and watching Comedy Central at night. just like this trippy feeling. And I have these bouts, like, I've just got to stop this. You know, I always thought I could stop. Like, I always thought I could just stop drinking when I wanted to. And I would stop for, like, a week or something, and people would compliment me at work. Like, oh, Sarah, you look so much better. But it would never stick. I was never able to stay stopped. And I made a decision. You know, I need to get married. So we know where this is going. Like, I just need to find a man. Like, I need to find a man, and this is how life looks. You know, all this other stuff before, all these consequences that I'm suffering. You know, I had already been institutionalized in a place. You know, all this stuff is just party girl behavior. I just need to get married and have kids and settle down. So I had a picture in my head of, like, what life was supposed to look like, you know, and I guess I based that off of what I thought I saw going on around me or television shows or something. And so I say, like, I married this guy. He's my ex-husband now, and he's totally cool. He is such a great guy. And he married a figment of my imagination. You know, he did not marry me. He married a girl who thought she wanted to get married, and I married up, you know, into this, like, high society family, and they would have these functions, and I wore Ann Taylor clothes, and it was just, like, I remember just being miserable. Like, I wanted to blow my brains out at these functions, like, and I would cry at night. I would drink way too much. I would do socially unacceptable things in these extremely socials. Like, these, like, these were very upstanding people, and I was very low standing. Like, oh, my God. The stories I think about now are funny, but back then, oof. I was just miserable, though. And the sad thing is, you know, looking back, it's like I just had no tools for life. Like, I had no connection with God. I had no sense that what I was suffering from was something spiritual. If you had told me that, if you had told me it was alcoholism, like, I wouldn't have cared. I mean, I kind of have always figured that I'm alcoholic, you know, based on my family history. I come from a long line of some drunk hillbillies, seriously, like Floyd County. I mean, these people on mopeds and motorcycles, and I mean, I could just tell you stories. I had this cousin Larry. He's deceased now, but he was a horrible alcoholic. And I remember him showing. And my mom was Italian, and so, like, I had this big Italian family on my mom's side, and, you know, very religious, like very religious. And I remember, you know, rosary clutching people. And I remember cousin Larry showing up at one of our family functions with, like, a case of Budweiser, and my grandmother going, God be merciful. Just redneck. So, and I always thought that was something else. Like, I've always thought something was wrong with me, and I could never put my finger, and that's, you know, it's like I thought, oh, well, because my dad was a hillbilly and my mom was, like, a Italian New Yorker, like, that doesn't mix. Like, of course something's wrong with me. But, you know. So I'm in this marriage, and I'm just miserable, and it's sad. You know, I had a daughter. I had a very healthy daughter. You know, I didn't drink during either of my pregnancies, and I was just kind of, I've always had good intentions. Like, my life has been filled with some good intentions, and that's obviously the road paved to we know where. But I could tell already where I was suffering from untreated alcoholism, I could really start pinpointing it with my daughter because I wasn't drinking because I was breastfeeding, and I was a nightmare to my husband. I mean, I created this environment that was constant walking on eggshells. I could still do that today because my kids are 7 and 10, and if I'm not embedded in my program and just doing the simple things each day that AA asked me to do, I mean, I become like that very quickly. Like, I'm just kind of crawling out of my skin. I can't stand it if, like, my kids hug me. It's just, you know, it's a nasty illness. It really is. So, yeah, you know, my husband would say, I'm going to be 5 minutes late, or I'll be home at 5. And if he came home at 5:05, I would jump down his throat and just, like, rip him apart. I mean, I was not pleasurable to live with, and I wasn't being treated at all. Like, I wasn't drinking, and I wasn't doing anything towards a solution. I was just, like, in my own misery, constantly thinking about, what am I getting out of this marriage, which was nothing, you know, what's in it for me, like Janet Jackson says. Just everything was about me. And I know I'm jumping around all over the place, but I want to be sure that I say this. In my first year of recovery, the most important thing that I learned in here, that my sponsor and my brother kept beating into me, if nothing else, you know, I didn't realize it was kind of 12-step stuff already, like, getting plugged into my ear, but, you know, it's not all about me. Whatever situation, like, work is not all about me. You know, this life is not all about me, because that's what kills me. And in my first year, I felt like, you know, I'll go on to say my son, he had a feeding tube when I got sober. He has a genetic defect. I don't want to say defect. He has a genetic disorder. And he was on a feeding tube when I got sober, and I was going through a divorce, and my mom had just passed away. So I had all these things, like all these cases that I was presenting, which is why I was drinking myself to death. And I wanted special treatment when I came to AA. You know, I remember telling my brother once, like, I just want someone to just cook me a meal. You know, I wanted to be comforted or something. And what he and my sponsor kept telling me was, you know, just, I had to stay at, you know, this is not about you. Oh, or my brother said once, like, oh, yeah, that's the perfect thing for an alcoholic. It's like, you know, just call somebody, go to a meeting, you know, make sure you're talking to your sponsor, and just take the basic actions, and it is not all about you. So I keep that with me today. Like, I have to, because I have that alcoholic self-centeredness that I want to naturally make things about me, and it's not. You know, we learn in here later on in the 11th step about the St. Francis prayer, you know, it's in self-forgetting that one finds, and that doesn't make sense, but it's like, it's so true to me. I'm always the happiest when I'm out of myself. Seriously, it's like that. I've heard a speaker say before, I never think about myself and spiral upward, ever, ever. So, and you know, and another thing, like, always, I grew up, I just always felt like I'm making the way I feel be the most important thing in the world, like basing how I treat others or how I show up at work or with my children, just everything based on how I feel. And I've learned, you know, no, I can still act sober. I can still act like a sober lady, even if I'm having a really bad day and I'm feeling pretty horrible. I don't have to hurt people's feelings and cause damage, you know. So, you know, what ended up happening, I blew up the marriage. Basically, I had the son. It was already, like, sinking, and I had this child. And Doc, he's such a good kid. He's 7 now. But like I said, he had a genetic disorder, and he was on a feeding tube for 5 years, and that includes when I got sober. So he became fully tube dependent. He didn't know how to eat or drink by mouth. And my mom passed away at the same time that this all was happening. And I told you I was very close to her. Her death was very unexpected and sudden. It's just like total blindsight. And so all this is happening. And I feel like I'd already crossed a line in my drinking, because our big book talks about at every alcoholic's life, we go from being a normal drinker to, you know, to not. But it's like, I don't understand normal drinking, because, like I said, from the first time I ever drank, it was abnormal to me. And, you know, I was, back then especially, I was so thick in the delusion, I thought that what happens to me when I drink happens to everybody, and that's not true. You know, when I drink, I don't know when I'm going to stop. And I get this kind of allergic reaction where, first of all, I get these effects by alcohol, and then I just want more and more, and I can't stop, you know. And normal people can have a few and put it down, and I didn't know all this was going on. So anyway, so my son's born, my mom's, and And kind of where a line was crossed for me, though, in my alcoholism, this is where I started drinking every day and started drinking in the morning. So I was a stay-at-home mom at the time, or stay-at-home drunk. And I remember I would put, like, I would start by putting whiskey in my tea, or I'd put Kahlua in my coffee and just kind of keep the buzz alive all day. And then my behaviors, like, I started going out. I made these friends in Richmond, and I would leave my husband at home with the kids, and I started going out. And my conduct as a woman in my early 30s was worse than my conduct as a college student. I mean, it's just, they say alcoholism is progressive, and it was absolutely progressive for me. It got worse with time. It never got better. This whole time between my first drink when I'm 16 to 33, it's like I keep making all these promises that I'm going to stop drinking. Like something inevitably would always happen. So I'm not drinking again. And I was never able to pull it off, ever, ever. And, you know, still, and I'll say this, you know, sometimes, so I have like 4.5 years now, I told you, it's so important for me to stay in the center of this thing and show up for my service commitments and just stay with the basics. Like, I'm a very basic girl. I just like to stay with the basics in AA. I like to show up where I'm supposed to. I like to say yes when I'm asked to do service. I like to, you know, stick my hand out to the newcomer, be involved in my home group. I like to do stuff like this because it can still cross my mind sometimes that, well, you know, of course I went crazy and off the deep end. You know, my son had this, my mom died, and my husband divorced me. So, of course, I went crazy and tried to drink myself to death. Like, maybe if I drink today, it'll be different. But you know what I mean? But this is why I have AA, because the truth is, you know, I'm completely powerless. I can't. If I have a drink tonight, like, I might stop that. I might drink for the next month. Like, I just don't know what's going to happen. So that's why I keep coming back, and I love AA, and it's, where was I? Oh, so my husband throws me out of the house. So all this is going on, and my behavior's caught up with me, just very unethical, immoral behaviors in my full-blown alcoholism, as we're all familiar with, and he throws me out of the house, and I was so upset because even though, you know, I really thought that I could somehow make this marriage work and I could somehow save it, but I just couldn't imagine being on my own, and I was terrified. Like, I didn't expect that consequence, I'll say that. That was probably, for me, my toughest blow in my alcoholism, was losing that marriage at the time. Now I'm grateful for it, because if I didn't lose it, I don't think I would have ever stopped drinking, honestly. But I remember one time being at work, and I'm trying to, like, make this marriage work, and my ex-husband was just like, no, no. And then, like, he calls me one day at work, and he says, I want you to know that I've met someone. And he felt strongly enough about her that he was going to move forward with, like, really dating her. And I'm still drinking at the time. I was living in this really, really horrible apartment in the museum district of Richmond. It was just gross, like roaches and just dingy. Like, now I could never live in a place like that. Like, I don't mean to be, you know, it was just gross. Sorry. But that, you know, for me, that moment when he told me about that girl, I remember hanging up the phone and going into the bathroom at work, and I was just pacing around like a caged animal. It's like that's when the gates of hell closed on me with a clang. That was my moment. And I remember I was engaging in all this behavior. I mean, it's, you know, the stuff that we do. And I just remember I just lost it. I feel like I had a nervous breakdown, and I was by myself in a bathroom, and I didn't know how to get out. And I remember grabbing the sink and looking at myself in the mirror and just hating with all of my guts everything that I was looking at. I mean, just everything. I thought about what I did to my husband. I know the mother I was bringing to the table. Like, it was everything. And I looked straight into my eyes, and I said, God, help me. Like, I think I yelled it, actually. And that's so pivotal for me, because this is another big book kind of parallel that I have. Our big book talks about inside every man, woman, and child, you know, is this kind of fundamental idea of God, that there's something else beyond us. I've definitely always felt that in my heart. You know, I did kind of grow up Catholic, but not really. I didn't pay attention. I didn't care. But I've always thought there was something else. It's weird to me, though. Like, and everything that I was going through, I felt like if there was a God, he definitely hated me, just like it talks about in the big book. I was like, God definitely hates me. He killed my mother. He gave me this sick child, and he just dissolved my marriage. Like, of course God hates me. So that's what's so weird to me, that I grabbed the sink and I cried out to that God, but I did. I was just so desperate. Like I said, I just broke. I didn't get sober right away, but that's where there was definitely a shift for me, for sure, because it occurred to me a few weeks after that, I was at my daughter's graduation for preschool, and they had this little event for the preschoolers, and they were showing each kid on a screen, and when they showed my daughter, it just hit me out of nowhere that, oh my God, I have a drinking problem. So I know now, like knowing what I know now, that I've been through the steps of AA, I know that the drinking is only a symptom of my overall problem, which is alcoholism. At the time, though, that was enough to get me interested in stopping and trying to fix this. And I went to my first AA meeting. I remember calling my brother, and I was like, and this is what's so heartbreaking to me, because I feel like this happens to a lot of us. He was trying to help me. He was trying to give me information about meetings that were solution-oriented. He was trying to put me in touch with women, and he had been actually trying to put me in touch with women for a while before that. I remember I had talked to a few women along the way. I remember I talked to this one girl in Richmond when I was still in the cups. I don't remember this, but she tells me that I said that she was talking to me about her alcoholism, and that I told her, this is Marcy, and I told her, yeah, it sounds like you have a problem. And then I just like got off the phone with her. I was still married at the time. So, yeah, he's trying to tell me, and this is what's so sad to me. Like, he's trying to tell me all these meetings, giving me women's numbers to call. And I was like, no, stop telling me what to do. I've got this. Like, there's a meeting within walking distance either way of me. Like, I'll just go to these meetings. And I would go right when the meeting started, and I would bounce right when it ended. I did not get a sponsor. I kept hearing about it in meetings, but I just was not. I was just miserable, and I would just sit there, and I would cry. Like, but I would go to meetings, and I was crying. And 2 weeks into this, I had such a firm resolve. Like, this was my moment. Like, I'm definitely quitting drinking now. See, now I'm going to AA. I'm serious. I'm definitely quitting. And I meant that. I meant that with all my heart. But I had nothing to block me from a drink, nothing. Because I just told you I wasn't doing anything. And it was so weird. Like, I woke up one Saturday morning. I didn't have the kids. And it was before I even opened my eyes. It was physiological for me. Like, I could feel my heart racing. Like, the obsession was on me already. Like, so I was opening my eyes. And I looked out the window. And I still remember it. It was like a total sapphire blue sky, clouds in the sky. And I'm just like... And I thought, you know, maybe I'll go to a meeting, though. Maybe I'll hear something. And this was another pivotal moment. You know, I believe that God speaks to us through each other. I've had so many experiences with that where I believe that to be true. And it's so, you know, for me to think that at that stage of my life, you know, it was just to me a very rudimentary understanding that there might be something else going on. If I really thought I was going to hear something from somebody that might make me stop drinking. So I go to the meeting and... You know, somebody could have dropped some serious truth, you know, the truth I've been waiting for my whole life or something. I wouldn't have heard it because, like, I was already an obsession. I was thinking about where I was going to get my wine, what wine was I going to get, and my body's just racing. And after the meeting, I just flew out of there like a bat out of Hades, and I went straight to the gas station, and I got some Pinot Grigio, and I was dating this guy on the south side, which is in Richmond, and... I mean, his house looked like a yard sale was going on at all times. Like, he was just like and so I just like show up at his house. And what's funny is like he might be one of us, I don't know, but he was great. Like, he partied hard. And what's so funny is I show up with my wine, and he's like, "Whoa, you said you weren't drinking anymore." Like, I was like, no, it's fine. Trust me. It's fine. So you drink this. And I was like tearing through his drawers like a wild animal looking for a wine key or a corkscrew. And he was not a wine drinker. I found it and I jammed it in there. And I remember breaking the cork. And I finally, the only way I got it open, I had like a steak knife and I like jammed it in there. And I crushed that thing in 20 minutes. And I was just so happy. Like, like even before I drank it, I mean, if you've all seen the movie Leaving Las Vegas, where that scene where Nick Cage is waiting outside the ABC store, and he's like chomping at the bit, and they let him in with his grocery cart, and he's like dancing through the liquor aisle. Like, I suddenly felt free before I even took the drink. You know, I could feel like that sober now. That's the amazing thing about the steps, is I can get that freedom from self sober without having to pick up a drink and cause wreckage and almost kill myself. So, yeah, I was off to the races for another 3 months, and I just stayed drunk. And my excuse this time was, well, I tried AA. It didn't work. So I just, like, had more, you know, more fuel for the fire. And I finally, you know, I didn't go out with a bang. I really definitely went out with a whimper, because I got so defeated. My last weekend, I'm so grateful to be where I am today, seriously. And I can promise you, like, my externals, really nothing has changed. My divorce is final, you know. My externals are basically the same, but I have changed so much. It's like, you know, we definitely get a new pair of glasses in here. It's wild to me. But I think back then, my last drunk weekend, I had my kids. And this is hard for me to say, because, like, I would never do this to them now. I don't think, you know, I'm powerless over alcohol, but if I stay in here, I won't do it again. I had this final weekend bender while I had my kids, and my son was still on his feeding tube, and I just drank. I just drank the whole time. I remember waking up from a blackout on Sunday night and not even knowing if my kids were in the house. And I remember that, like, fear pounding through me, and I ran and I made sure they were in bed. But, I mean, again, my son's on a continuous feeding pump, and it just freaked me out. Like, I bottomed out. Like, I can't internally, like, I can't even tell you. Like, he was in bed, and I was like, thank God. And I remember, like, sitting down on the floor, and he had this nightlight that looked like a fish on the wall. And I remember staring at it and deciding I was going to kill myself. Like, I made a decision. I was like, this is the only way these kids have a shot at a normal life, is if I am totally out of the picture. And I really believed that to be true. I was drunk, obviously, you know. I made a decision, and then I just went to bed. It's like, you know, I'll do it tomorrow or something. I don't know what happened. I just, like, went to bed. Oh, no, first I went and I got a beer in the fridge. I was, like, scrounging around. Like, the only alcohol that I had left in the house, I had, like, one lone Corona, like, jammed in the back of the fridge. And I chugged that, and I went to bed. And this is the power of God in my life. So, like I just told you, I had no intentions of quitting or coming to AA, like, zero. And when I woke up the next morning from that, it was like Bill talks about in his story. I felt like quicksand was stretching all around me. You know, I had been defeated. Alcohol was my master. I just saw with all this clarity what was going on. It's like the shades were brought open for like a minute, and it was, I was terrified. I was so scared. I remember, like, I didn't even check on my kids or anything at that point. I didn't even get out of bed. I grabbed my phone and I called my brother right away. And he, I was like, I need help. Like, I remember I was freaking out, and he was like, just, you know, here's what you do. Just bring the kids to your ex-husband's and then call me back. And he really had to, like, walk me through the day. And when I called him again, he gave me this woman's number. And this is another God shot. You know, when I can look back with, like, an open mind in my life, I could see the hand of God moving all over the place despite me, you know. And I like to keep that in mind today. But he had been at a conference that weekend that I was in my last bender, and a woman had given him my sponsor's phone number. She said, well, he had been talking about me, and she said, well, have you had her call X person? And he had said, I don't know why I never thought of her. So she gave him that number, and then I called him that next day. And so he had it. He's like, Sarah, I don't know why I never thought about this woman. Give her a call. Call me back right when you get her. And so I called her, and like I said, she's my sponsor now, but we talked, and I told her, you know, she called me back, and, you know, my brother's checking in through the day, and she asked for me to meet her at a meeting. And I remember my first AA meeting that I came to with her, I wouldn't even go inside. Like, I called her from the parking lot. I'm like, are you there? It's so funny to me now. I didn't want to go in, and she's like, yeah, I'm here. I'm in the parking lot. And I was like, which one are you? But, so I remember that when I'm working with new people. You know, we're not all there. You know, when we first come in here, life's a wreck. It's a 911 call for sure. And I remember when I met her, like, I didn't like her, to be truthful, because she's very peaceful. She was still a stay-at-home mom. She is a stay-at-home mom. She was talking about gardening, and I just remember being so resentful, like, it makes of you to still have a marriage. And gardening, like, and I hate gardening. And so I called my brother after. She asked me if I wanted to go to Starbucks after the meeting, and I said yes. That's so weird to me. See, God, all I had to do was ask for help, and I got it. Seriously, I really think that prayer was the pivotal moment when I looked in the mirror and, like, meaning it with all my heart. I think it's what, like, changed the course of my life, seriously, because I look back and I just see the hand of God everywhere. I said yes to going out to coffee with this woman I didn't like, and I called my brother on the way, and I said, because I told you I had tried AA meetings before, and I didn't get a sponsor, and I didn't get a home group, and I didn't do anything, and I saw what happened. I saw my last weekend with my children. And so I called my brother and I said, I'm thinking about asking this woman to sponsor me. What do you think? Is that poor AA etiquette? Like, do you wait? I don't know. Like, I didn't know what to do. Like, and he said, he was just quiet on the phone, and I thought we had gotten disconnected. And I was like, hello? Hello? He's like, sir, that is the best idea you've ever had in your life. He goes, you ask her to sponsor you, and you do whatever. No, he didn't tell me. He never told me to ask her to sponsor me. He says, you do whatever she tells you, or else you're going to die. Like, I remember him saying that. So when I met her for dinner, you know, I told her, I mean, for the coffee, I asked her to sponsor me, and she asked me, you know, am I willing to go any lengths? And I said yes, and she agreed to sponsor me. It was so cute. Like, I remember walking back to the car. We're in this little shopping center called The Village, and I'm like, oh, and I'm on all these medications. I'm on... And I, like, listed off, like, 7 medications, and she looked alarmed. Like, I remember her face, and I was like, do you think? And, like, drinking very heavily on top of all of them. And I remember, like, being like, do I go off them right now? Like, I'm supposed to do that, right? She's like, no, don't do anything right now. Just that stuff's going to shake out. Just keep doing what you're doing, and, you know, so, you know, for right now. And but it's just so funny to me because her face was like, it's funny. I got this flea infestation in my house in my first year of sobriety. So, like, I had this cat that I wasn't putting Frontline on because everything just went crazy. So I got this, like, horrible flea infestation, and I had to go on steroids because I'd scratched all the skin off my legs, and I could only handle the steroids for 2 days. Like, I'm so highly affected by medication now. Like, I can't take anything. It affects me too badly. And, so the fact that I was seriously on 7 medications and drinking the way I was, like, I don't know how I was walking around. I probably shouldn't have been. So it's like Keith Richards, I was being preserved by the alcohol. That's why I look so young. But, so I got the sponsor, and my life changed. It changed, not right away. I was miserable. I was in horrible shape. Dawn is one of my, she's actually my best friend, and she has 25 years of solid recovery, and she's not my sponsor, but she's been pivotal in my recovery. Like, I'd be dead without her, you know. I remember just blowing up your phone my first 2 years just with nonsense and obsessions and drama and wanting to kill myself, and just so patient. Like, the loving hand of AA was there, you know. And my sponsor, we started going through the steps. She would meet me every week, and we'd read the big book, and then we just took actions. Like, when the big book said, you know, say the third step prayer, we said the third step prayer. I got a home group right away. I mean, very basic things that keep me sober today, just being plugged in. That's it. It's not... Sometimes it can feel overwhelming to me, but it's like I just have to stay plugged in, and I can stay sober. That's it. You know, I did a very thorough fourth step. I was desperate. You know, I was given the gift of desperation, and I'm so thankful because I remember barreling through my fourth step in, like, 2 weeks or less, honestly. And I like that saying, like, you don't, when you're running through hell, you don't slow down. And I felt like that. You know, I just went through it quickly. And I did a fifth step, and my fifth step was incredible. You know, I've spent my life on psychiatrist sofa since I was 14, honestly. And the piece that was missing, I've had doctors really try to help me. I have no problem with doctors. Like, people have always cared and tried to help. But I didn't realize the thing that was missing was that power of one alcoholic working with another. And here was a woman that got me. And she'd pretty much done everything I'd done. It's just nothing rattled her. Like, I didn't say one thing that made her go, oh, you know, you're crazy, you know. She's just very peaceful and loving. And that's like, that was my fifth step is when I, my first fifth step is when I first felt that presence of God. Like, seriously, like, I feel like her facial features even changed. Like, she didn't even look like herself. It was weird. It was a very spiritual experience for me. And then six and sevens, you know, these defects of character and humbly asking them to be removed, that my understanding of that and my willingness for that grows as time goes on and the path narrows and my spirit can't take certain things that it could take maybe a year or two ago. You know, being more willing to accept the power of change and wanting and not being so scared of change anymore, because, like, I've never changed for the worst, you know. And, you know, since I've been on this spiritual path, I mean. So my amends process, I made amends to my ex-husband at, God, I was early. It was like 4 or 5 months sober. And it was a catastrophe. It was such a catastrophe. But I can tell you what, you know, he ended up getting remarried in the process. And I did not get along with his new wife at the time. Okay, let's just leave it at that. We're in polite company. I made their first year of marriage hell. I really did. And I had made amends to him, but still, I was just all over the place. You know, I didn't have a lot of time to practice this stuff and, you know, just kind of coming into my own in sobriety. I can tell you now, 4.5 years later, I'm friends with that woman. We all raised the children together. We were at a basketball game yesterday for my daughter, and she and I are just like, just totally ignoring him. It's like we co-parent so well together, and it is absolutely about because of AA and the principles that we practice in here, it's cool. Like, I sleep well at night. Like, I'm not caught up in resentment at them or what they're doing. And I'm not going to lie, like, stuff will still show up sometime. Like, we had an incident a few months ago, you know, where it got tense. But it's like, again, I'm getting so much better practice that I'm acting like a recovered, sober person, you know? Just being a normal person in polite society and learning. It's been hard for me. You know, I used to just kind of be a doormat. And my sponsor would say, Sarah, there's nothing spiritual. You know, it's one thing or the other. I was either, like, exploding and ripping their heads off, or I was being a total doormat. And my sponsor had to teach me, you know, there's nothing spiritual about being a doormat. We're not servile or scraping. We stand on our own 2 feet. And I've been able to take this in every area of my life. So I've learned how to stand on my own 2 feet, and that can be uncomfortable sometimes. And as an alcoholic, I don't like to be uncomfortable, but I've learned to live in that discomfort of the tenth step and learn that I'm okay. Like, it's going to be okay. I just be uncomfortable for a little while. It's all right. The 11th step has absolutely changed my life. I love 11th step work. I love seeing where religious people are right, making use of what they offer. I love checking in with God every morning and every night and throughout the day. Just having a sense of, with my spiritual awakening has come the sense of God consciousness that I talked about earlier. You know, that I definitely believe, like, there's something else going on beyond me. If I could just stay out of myself and remove me from me enough to participate in life and let God do his thing, you know, I don't need to be all stressed out and uncomfortable from untreated alcoholism. And then the 12th step, practicing these principles in all my affairs and carrying the messages to other alcoholics. This is definitely a program that I have to keep in the day. You know, I really try not to think too far out, because it's like I'm cognizant that I only have a daily reprieve. It's so true for me. And, you know, I'm having a good run right now. I've had a very calm few weeks. That's not to say things haven't shown up, but I've just been doing very well lately. But it's like, it's just kind of the calm. I know that something else is going to happen again, you know. And that's not to say, like, I can be just as crazy as anybody on any given day or any given moment. I mean, seriously, I've really learned to relax and just be comfortable with myself. I mean, it's a program of imperfection. I still have resentments. I still have fears. The cool thing is like I have a way to deal with life now through AA. And again, it's like I'm a very, I just stay like in the rudimentary kind of scope of this thing. I go to my home group and I show up early and I stick out my hand. I answer the phone when it rings because that changes my thinking even when I don't want to. I stay in touch with my sponsor. I reach out to other women. And again, I try to say yes whenever I can. And I try to be transparent in all areas of my life. Like, I've gotten sober in my finances. Like, I'm still broke, but it's different. It's like I was spending a lot, especially in early sobriety. It's like I didn't realize this concept of being transparent in every area of your life. Like, yeah, you look good in AA meetings, and you might look good at work, but what does your relationship with your kids look like when you have them, or what does your bank account look like? Like, it's really a program that's helped me in all areas of my life. Like, I didn't realize that's what AA was. I thought I just needed to quit drinking. And what I didn't realize is that when I quit drinking and I don't practice a spiritual program of recovery, that's when my problems really start. They really start. Like, I'm serious, you guys. My first year was brutal, and I'm so grateful that I stayed sober through it. And it's something that I definitely want to stay and pass on. So I'm really humbled that y'all stuck around, even though it's Super Bowl. Like, thank you. Nobody left, so that means a lot. All right, have a good night.